Okay, we're going to begin, so everybody grab a seat. We'll get started. All right, I'm going to start us off with just a little bit about the scriptures. And I want to, each week I'd like to review where we've been just so that we keep those things in mind about what the scriptures say about our finances. And I'll just pass through it real quickly. Week number one, we learned that the Bible teaches that we're to have a plan for our finances. And remember we talked about building a tower. Well, we don't build towers, but we do build families. And so it's really important to do that. We don't want to run out of money before we run out of month and so forth. Week number two is a reminder to us that all of our finances, everything that we have is from the Lord. He's the creator. He's the owner of everything. And so when he provides for us, anything that we have is provided by him. And we need to remember that. Third week, we are to be content and not covetous. We need to avoid covetousness with whatever we have. And the Bible says if we have our needs covered, if we have housing and food, that we're to be content. And that's pretty basic. If the Lord gives us more, praise the Lord for that. And he does. He is a gracious God, and we're thankful for that. Week number four, want to talk just a little bit about the privilege of finances, the privilege of money, and what we use our money for. And the first thing is we do that to provide for ourselves. Philippians 4:19 says, "And my God will supply all of your need." And when we read that verse a couple weeks ago about God supplying all of our needs, we emphasized the fact that God is a supplier. Today, when we talk about it, he's talking about our needs, the things that we need. We need food and clothing and housing and so forth and some pleasures as well. So it's important to see that. He does that according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus. Second thing is we need to provide for our family. And this is a very stark verse in 1 Timothy 5:8. It says, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." That's a pretty stark statement, I think, you know, that we don't provide for our own family. If we go out and spend it all on our own pleasures and don't take care of our families. He says we're worse than unbelievers. That's what unbelievers would do. And so we do want to provide for our families. Here's another one, number three, to give to others in need. I think we don't always think about that, but James 2:15-17 says, "If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warm, be filled.'" In other words, you know, let the Lord bless you. I'm not going to do anything. That's the wrong thing to do. And it says, "And you do not give them what is necessary for their body. What use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead." You know, and I thought about that one because there are lots of ways that we can help others. Just being aware of the needs of others. Recently, I saw somebody come up to another person and give them some money and said, I know you have need of this. There was a little while ago that somebody handed me an envelope full of money and said, "I want you to go give it to so-and-so, but I don't want you to tell them where you got it." And I thought that was a really good thing to do. Sometimes it's knowing about a need. It might be maybe some computer equipment or, you know, something little or even something a little big. And if you know about that need and can reach out and help them, because even if it costs you a little bit, it's a good thing to do. It's to think about the needs of others. Here's Here's another one, and I like MacArthur's commentary on this one. He said, this is 1 Timothy 6, verses 17 through 19, and it says, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. And in the world standards, everybody in this room is pretty rich. You may not feel that at times, but that's the truth. But we're to depend upon God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasures of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. And John MacArthur commented on that last little phrase, and I like the way he put it. He says, Paul here is admonishing Timothy to get a grip. Can you imagine John MacArthur saying that? To get a grip on the reality of the matters associated with eternal life, so that he would live and minister with a heavenly and eternal perspective. And that's the way we need to live our lives. We need to think about things with eternity's values in view, and not so much on the temporal things that we have in our pocket. And the fourth one is to give to the church. 1 Timothy 5, 17 and 18, the elders who rule well are to be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard in preaching and teaching. And I think it's particularly directed to those that we pay, because it says, for the scripture says, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. And so we think about our pastors and how we support them, how important that is. We don't muzzle the ox while it's threshing, and it's the picture is the ox is threshing the grain, and they would put the muzzle on the ox, some people, so that it couldn't eat some of the grain. And he's saying, don't do that. They're to be able to partake of that as well, part of their labors. And so that's how we treat our elders, our pastors. 2 Corinthians 8, verses 3 to 5 says, for I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much urging for the favor of participation in support of the saints. And this not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. What a great testimony that is of those who gave abundantly to the work of the Lord. So I just want you to think about those things as we think about money. We're going to think about money and investing and all those sort of things and building some sort of a portfolio, but let not that be the main end of things. We realize that we're not going to take any of this with us, and we need to think about things with eternity's values in view. So let me pray, and we'll let Howard come. Our Father, we do thank you for your word. Thank you for your abundant provision for all of us. But help us not to focus solely on building a portfolio or our own needs. Help us to think with eternity's values in view, knowing that we can't take everything. And what a pleasure it is to serve you and to serve others. And just pray that you would help us to be mindful of that. Now we pray that you would bless Howard as he comes and bless each one of us. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Well, Dwight, thank you for starting us off with an excellent introduction. I'm going to follow up with a verse from Ecclesiastes 11, verse 2, which says, invest in seven ventures, yes, in eight. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land. Now, with that as an introduction, what do you think we're probably going to be discussing this evening?
Diversity.
And it'll be diversity of fixed instruments or equity investments? Yes, exactly. We talked about fixed instruments, and we looked at bank savings and credit unions and that sort of thing. There were two guarantees associated with those. What were they? FDIC, so it was insured. If you put money into a bank, you're going to get it back. Okay, what's the other one? guaranteed rate of return, and it's not going to make enough money to overcome the tax obligation and any inflation that we might experience. So we know that we have a need for those fixed instruments. What are a couple of the requirements? Why do we need to have savings? Okay. One of them is emergency fund, right? If there's an illness or death in the family, you can hop on an airplane and fly home, and not putting a Visa or MasterCard at how much interest? Any 20-something, generally. And we also have it for contingency accounts, short-term needs, known short-term needs like new tires for the car, anniversaries, birthdays, Christmas, and those sorts of things that we can pay cash for, we can plan on, rather than putting it on the plastic passports to poverty. Now, speaking of anniversaries, in case you've forgotten, Dwight and Nancy Custis are celebrating 50 this week. And the reason that he won't be here on the 11th is they're going on their 50th celebratory cruise with the family, going to Alaska. So we'll be down here sweltering and working hard, and they'll be up there in the cooling, just goofing off. But congratulations, Dwight. We're really happy for y'all. And proud of it, that's right. Okay, so let's switch gears. We're going to talk about equity investing. And first question is, which equity investment best satisfies your objective of long-term growth? As you can tell, there's a broad diversity of different kinds of equities to choose from. There's a couple of things that are shared by each and every one of these. One is that fortunes have been made in each and every one of those equity investments. True statement. What's the corollary? Fortunes have been lost in each and every one of those equity investments. And I'm going to start this discussion off with a spoiler alert. I've been investing in equities for almost 50 years now, but I emphasize the word investing. I'm not a gambler. I'm not a speculator. I'm an investor. And so in our discussions tonight, I'm not going to be talking about futures, options, and commodities. I'm not going to be talking about investing with puts and calls. I'm not going to talk about having a cattle feedlot operation or an oil and gas well drilling venture. Okay, we're going to talk about things that most people can relate to that has a risk-reward ratio, and we'll discuss that in more detail, that is more appropriate for the majority of the folks that are here this evening. So we have a number of different items to choose from, and there are some very specific keys to investing. The first of these is the time is on your side. Two thoughts here. Number one, we talked about this several times, the earlier you start investing, the better that you're going to have as a result because you've got compound interest working for you over a longer period of time, right? Good. The second thing is, and I think this is important when we talk about equity investing, as far as the amount of time that you should have for the goal that you're shooting for, no less than 5 years. If you have a goal of putting together money for a down payment on a home 3 years from now, you shouldn't be investing in equity investments. Why? If you have to withdraw it and the market is down, you could take a significant hit. All right, over a five-year period, you've got a much better opportunity of stabilizing, of leveling things out. So if you have a short-term need, stay with fixed instruments. For a longer-term opportunity, you can certainly consider equity investing. Now, one thing that we know for a fact is with equities, you can lose money. Okay, there is risk involved. It can be a prudent risk, but generally, high returns equal high risk. This is the risk-reward ratio. The higher the risk, the higher potential return generally. Not always, but generally. And if you stabilize the risk, then you will normally have a lower potential return. Doesn't always happen that way, but typically it does. You need to understand your risk tolerance, and the risk tolerance varies with each individual. If you're drinking Maalox cocktails for lunch, because of the fact that you're investing in equities, you're probably in the wrong equities. Okay, it's not worth that, I promise you. And it's not necessary. You shouldn't be taking those kinds of risks if your tolerance won't permit it. And the final item is diversification limits risk. Now, I key here on the word limits. That's not eliminates. All right? It limits risk. It reduces risk. It controls risk. It doesn't eliminate it. So if your investment strategy is to diversify across 10 very aggressive, very speculative stocks, and you say, okay, I'm diversified, so I think this is a great way for me to get rich in my lifetime, you're fooling yourself. That is not asset allocation in its finest sense. You're not truly diversified. And we'll talk about how we can do that as we go through the evening. So let's take these investing criteria and look, first of all, at stocks. What are stocks and how do they work? Well, stocks, very simply, are nothing but part ownership in a company. That's all. It just means that you own part of a company. There's two different kinds, generally. You got preferred stocks and common stocks. Common stocks will provide you with dividends or a portion of the profit that the company realizes. And with the common stock comes the privilege of voting for the board of directors. So you have the opportunity to step forward and say, okay, these are the individuals that I want running this company. Preferred stocks, on the other hand, are more oriented toward income. They typically have a defined level of income, and you don't have the opportunity to vote for the board of directors. So two different kinds of stocks, two different purposes, generally, and you just need to know that that is why they are there. Now, why is it that we have stocks? Why do companies issue stocks? Capital. What was the one back here?
Helps the company grow.
So it provides capital, and with that capital, they can grow. All right, they can do their research and development. They can do expansion. They can increase market share. They can do all sorts of things with those dollars, but that's typically what they're trying to provide. Now, as far as considerations and resources, we know that you buy stocks through brokers. There's really two different kinds. We have full service, and these are individuals that will not only process, buy, and sell orders for you, but they also do research. And they will advise you. They'll give you advice. They charge for that, though. Okay? Discount brokers are generally going to be more oriented toward executing buy and sell orders. So you just have to decide what is it that you want for a broker to do for you. Now, with the brokers, you need to do, as well as your brokerage firms, you need to do your research. And you've heard me talk about this, and basically every aspect of personal finance that we've discussed so far, do your research. And where I would like you to start is with an organization called FINRA, F-I-N-R-A. You can pull them up. Their website is finra.org. That is an acronym for the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. And their predecessor was the NASD, the National Association of Securities Dealers. It is a self-regulating organization, an SRO. And so the various brokerage houses and mutual funds and such are all participating in making sure that their members are doing things properly. All right? So, the FINRA is the first place to start. You can check and see if the brokers that you are considering, whether it be someone that you dropped in on because of an invitation to have lunch at their expense, okay, and then hear their spiel, or was it a referral from a neighbor or a good friend of yours? always look them up, make sure that there's no outstanding baggage that they've carried into today with them. There are some distinct advantages when you're looking at stocks. To begin with, they have higher potential growth and reward than fixed investments. Historically, they have outpaced fixed instruments. And long-term growth of stocks has outpaced not only the interest paid on fixed instruments, but also outpaced the cost of living, which is the inflation index that we've experienced over the years. But with advantages, we also have disadvantages. To begin with, stocks have higher risk than fixed investments. Single stock investments is particularly risky due to a lack of diversification. So if you're going to invest in $100,000 worth of New Zealand offshore diamond mine stock, good upside potential, okay? Not a lot of downside protection. So it could be a really good return or it could be a really bad loss. No diversification, extra risky when you do that. And it requires research and knowledge to make sure that you're on the right track. So stocks are ownership in a company, but keep in mind they're not really a gamble. I hear people talk about playing the stock market. I don't like the notion of playing the stock market. I don't think that you should be making your buy and sell decisions based on hunches, based on rolling the dice. And some people actually do that, believe it or not. It should be an informed decision based on very precise investment strategies that you've designed for yourself that you know will work for you. Okay? So we have stock advantages and disadvantages. In addition to that, we have bonds. If stocks are reflecting a part ownership in a company, what is a bond? I heard something, debt. Ownership of debt. You're right. You're right on track. It is, in fact, an IOU. Okay, so you're loaning your money to either a corporation or a government entity, and they are fixed income investments. Why are they fixed income? Because for a specified period of time, they're going to use your money, and then they're going to pay you back with a declared rate of return on that loan. So the specified period of time is the maturity date, and the percentage is also fixed. You'll know what the amount is before you get involved with it. Now, with the bonds, because of the fact that they are IOUs, and you have a fixed maturity date, it's important that you know just exactly what type of bonds you're considering. Corporate bonds are, as the name implies, issued by corporations large and small. They can be a mammoth company like General Electric. It can be a startup entity that has four employees and one truck. Okay? You probably aren't going to see something that small most of the time, but it could be. Municipal bonds, as the name implies, you have cities, counties, states that are going to issue these, once again, for development purposes. And the municipal bonds, most generally, are tax advantaged. You aren't going to be paying income tax on the earnings from the municipals. The next four are issued by the federal government. And you have treasury bonds, and those are typically for periods over 10 years. Treasury notes for 2 to 5 years, treasury bills for 3 months to 2 years, and then you got U.S. savings bonds. And there's right now three different categories of bonds. You got E, I, and H series of bonds. Now, some of you in the room, not a lot of you, but some of you are old enough to remember back many years ago, back in the 50s, when we would take our little quarter to school and we'd give it to the teacher. And the teacher would give us a stamp, right? And we had our book, and we placed the stamp in the book. And then at the end of the semester, your book was full, and the teacher would give you a savings bond And that was in exchange for your little book of stamps. It was a great way to teach thrift. And then the bond, it was a real savings bond. It wasn't just not a Xerox copy. What did we have? Mimeograph copy. We didn't have Xerox back then. A mimeograph copy. But you could use it for savings, and it would be growing at some stated rate of interest. Well, we still have savings bonds, and we have zero coupon bonds. Zero coupon bonds are an interesting aberration of the bond system because they are typically designed not for income but for growth. And so what they do is they strip out the coupons, which are designed to provide the interest or the income, and the bond then is going to be paid at maturity, and you will have the return on the bond less the income. So that's why it's zero coupons. Coupons being what is normally used to provide income. So just keep in mind that your bonds are typically going to be used to provide income for specified periods of time at specified rates of return, and it is a good way to diversify. When you start talking about asset allocation, this is a great way to allocate assets away from just stocks and away from just fixed instruments. Banks, savings and loans, and that sort of thing. Okay, let's go to selecting a bond. There's a number of different considerations that we ought to consider. To begin with, the issuer, which would be either the company or the municipality, whoever it should be, that the issuer is going to affect not only the credit rating of the bond, but it's also going to affect the price. The maturity is going to reflect the return, and the reason is very simple. It's one of predictability. Which is more predictable? What's going to happen next week or what's going to happen in June of 2025? Next week. So a shorter term note is going to have a higher level of predictability, and because of the higher level of predictability, you're going to have a lower rate of return, but it'll be more stable. It's a balancing effect there. Credit quality, which is the issuer's ability to repay. And typically the government issued elements are more stable. You've heard talk of junk bonds. Junk bonds are from companies or corporations that are historically troubled. There are reasons that it's not a highly rated bond. So that's going to have an effect on the credit quality. And there are essentially three risks that you're going to have to expose yourself to. To begin with, the call risk, C-A-L-L risk. And what that means is that the entity, whether it's a corporation or the municipality, has the right to pay off that particular bond before maturity. So if you are planning on a 10-year return, and after 2 years it's called, it's paid off, then your long-range plan or intermediate-range plan has not worked for you. That's a risk. In addition to the call risk, you have credit risk. That is that the issuer may default. If you have a small town, or you have a small corporation or a corporation that's not being properly managed and it's having difficulties, it might default. And if it defaults, then the bonds could go with it. And the final risk is interest rate risk. If interest rates are rising, then the value of the bond could be falling. They're typically inverse. So that can also contribute to the call risk. If there is a right to call, the company may decide that it's now that we need to call this and reissue new bonds so that we don't have to pay out as much interest rate. If I'm borrowing money and I can pay out less money, then that's good for me. It's not necessarily good for the person who's loaned me money, though. All right, so we have These considerations in selecting the bond. Now, there are very distinct advantages to selecting the bond. That is, the predictability is key. You have fixed income for a defined period of time. So in my circumstances, for instance, I didn't have many bonds. I had a few, but they were very select as I was investing, as I was working. I was more oriented toward growth than I was income because I had income from my job. As I retired, then income became much more important to me. And so now when you look at my wife's and my portfolio, we have a much higher percentage of bonds incorporated in there than we do stocks and mutual funds, other select equities, if you would, because of the fact that this is more likely to provide income for us than the others would. Higher source of income than cash investments or stocks. Inclusion in the portfolio provides diversification. That's our asset allocation. And income from some bonds is tax exempt, which is a tax advantage. We're going to be talking about tax advantages here in just a little bit. So bonds can be a very good addition to your overall portfolio. So you have bond advantages, but that doesn't mean there are no advantages. It's not without some difficulty. To begin with, fluctuations in interest rates can create an environment where your bonds are going to become less stable. It could excite the call risk, the risk of issuer default. We talked about that risk just a minute ago. The value of interest affected by inflation and corporate decisions may affect credit quality and or market price. So you've got tactical decisions made by company management, and you have strategic decisions made by the board of directors. All right. Either one of those can make decisions that are effectively positive for the returns on the corporation or not so good. And the same with the municipalities. So advantages and disadvantages with stocks and bonds. Now, if you want to look at further diversification, then what you can do is look at ways of buying bonds that will allow you to do other things at the same time. For instance, the majority of bonds are sold by brokers. There are also bonds sold to banks, and you can buy government bonds from the Bureau of Public Debt at that particular address that's on the screen. So you have a number of different sources that you can buy those from, both in person and online. And if you're working with a broker, you're working with a bank, you can look at other ways of saving or investing while you're there. Once again, looking at asset allocation, looking at diversification. Now, if you don't have the time, the experience, the background, the knowledge, the inclination to invest in one of these, how about a mutual fund? How many of you have or are investing in a mutual fund? Let me see a show of hands. A number of you are. Okay, excellent. A mutual fund, very simply, is an equity investment that combines the investment dollars of people with similar objectives. So if we were to take those of us in this room and say, we want our assets to grow. We're not really concerned with income. We want the money to grow. We don't want to invest overseas, okay? And we don't want to invest in especially small companies. We want to invest in larger companies that are more oriented toward growth, all right? Then we provide continuous professional management. So since those of us in the room really don't have the information and the knowledge and the resources available to us to make lots of those decisions, we hire a pro to do it for us. In this case, we have our faithful leader, Dwight Custis. And Dwight is going to be our money manager. Okay? Good. And we, yeah, that's a good thing.
Then we don't need all this.
That's right. That's right. Just give it to Dwight.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Let's hope not. Yeah. So we got Dwight. We have a pro. Here's a guy that's going to be making our buy and sell decisions for us, all right? He's going to do our research, and he's going to invest in a broadly diversified group of securities. So with the mutual fund, we may have 50, 100, 500, 1,000 different companies and industries, a diversified number of companies and industries that we're going to own part ownership in through the mutual fund. And the person who's making those buy and sell decisions is our money manager, Dwight. We're going to pay him, by the way, for making these decisions for us. And the better he does in making money for us, the better he's going to be paid. All right, that's a very capitalistic way of doing things. So we have mutual funds that are available to do that. This is a mutual fund is really perfect for smaller investors because there are mutual funds that don't require a large initial investment. So you don't have to have $100,000 or $500,000 to invest in a lot of mutual funds. You can have much, much less than that. All the way down the least I know is $25. Okay, that's possible. You can take that as a positive for a smaller investor to move forward with. Now, when we're looking at our mutual funds, there's three things that we'll use to analyze what we're doing. We have value, which is also called net asset value. With a mutual fund, the value is determined at the end of each trading day. All right? And what they do is take the total value of all the holdings in that mutual fund. So if they have 100 stocks and they have 100 shares of each stock, then all of those shares are added together so you have a total value, and it's divided by the total number of shares that are outstanding in the mutual fund. All right, so you've got shares that you're owning of stock and shares of the mutual fund as well. You divide by the total value of the shares of stock that you own by the total number of shares in the mutual fund. That gives you the net asset value. Performance, then, is used as a percentage to analyze gains and losses of the NAV over various periods of time. It could be over a week, over a month, over a quarter, a year, 5 years, 10, 20 years. So you've got various periods of time that you can use to see what the performance of that specific mutual fund is. Now, why is that important? You want one that did well. See how it performed over time, and time is a good indication. It's not a guarantee, but it's an indication. You also want to be able to see how you're doing in relationship to the industry. What else is available? We're doing homework here, right? And we may be satisfied with what's going on, but there may be something that is doing much better with no more risk. So our risk-reward ratio is intact. We're just getting a better return for our investment. And we'll see how we can do that kind of research here in just a couple minutes. And then distributions. We have essentially two different kinds of distributions. We have dividends. Once again, let's go back. We said we had 100 different companies that our mutual fund owned. And each of those 100 companies, we own 100 shares of, right? Each of those 100 companies then issues a dividend. And the dividend is nothing but a portion of the profit that the company has made. So we take all those dividends, and once again, we divide it by the number of shares that we have in the mutual fund. So each share owner receives their pro rata portion of the dividends that we receive. The same with the capital gains. Right? What's an easy way to explain a capital gain? Money that you make from the money you invest. Okay, so if we have 100 companies with 100 shares and our money manager sells one of those companies, all 100 shares, and he bought them at $1 and he sold them at $2 per share, we have a $100 capital gain, right? If we've held it for less than a year, it's short term. Longer than a year, it's long term. But it's a capital gain in either case. And, yes, sir?
Just a question. The mutual funds go up for long term investing or short term?
Yes. No, yes. It's both. There is a broad, diversified number of objectives that you can choose from. And that broad, diversified objective is really going to depend upon what your specific strategy is at that point in your life. So it can be long-term, it could be short-term. Once again, I would not encourage you to invest in a mutual fund for less than 5 years, except for a money market fund. And with a money market fund, that's got a net asset value of a dollar, and we're going to talk about that in a second. Okay? So you've got value, performance, distributions. Those three are going to go into the analysis. And we've got objective sources, three objective sources that I think that you would be well served by looking at. I do not recommend you go out and buy each of these. They're very expensive, but you'll find them in any well-stocked library. One is Johnson's Charts. Johnson's Charts. The next one is Wiesenberger, Wiesenberger. Wiesenberger. Okay, so Wiesenberger and then Morningstar. With those three, you're going to find most information that you'd be looking for. And you got Motley Fool, and you got some other things that you can go to. But those three, I think, are probably the most sound of the research tools. Okay, let's turn our attention to index funds. An index fund is nothing but a mutual fund. And index funds own stocks that represent a specific market as a whole. So what kind of indexes are there? You've heard of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's based on 30 large industrial stocks, right? The S&P 500, the Standard & Poor's 500, is based on 500 stocks. So you're looking at a broad market of specific stocks that you feel are going to outperform the averages for the future. Index funds are generally mid to high risk. They earn average stock market gains and losses. Why? Because they're indexed to the market. That's right. To different portions of the market, to different percentages of the market, but you're indexed to the market regardless. And because of that, it's going to be fairly close to the averages. So these are ideal for those people who don't try to beat the market. They generally have lower fees and lower capital gains. Why lower fees? Say again. They're not managed. That's right. Yeah, the computers manage these things. So if there's a change of a stock in the S&P 500, then that change is going to be noted next time that it's run, but you don't have anybody making buy and sell decisions, right? What you have are people and computers most often that are reflecting those particular indexes. So the capital gains for the same reason. You're not going to have capital gains because you're not going to be doing much in the way of changing the stock issues that you own. They're only going to change when the index changes. Okay, so they're not going to have a high aggressive turnover rate. Now, some sample indexes are the S&P 500, Standard & Poor's, which is large companies, very large companies. Wilshire 5000, combination of large and small. The Russell 2000, which are those stocks that are traded over the counter. EAFE is Europe, Australia, and the Far East. So that's where you'd be buying that. See, what you could do is you could have some shares of the S&P 500, which are large domestic companies. You could have some shares of the Russell 2000 and some shares of the EAFE, which gives you an overseas component. So you could diversify significantly your holdings by looking at different balances on index funds. And they have frequently beaten managed funds, especially in recent years because of the markets that have been exposing themselves, okay, the way that companies are reacting to various market circumstances and situations. Now, most of your index funds are no loads. That means they don't have a sales charge. And they are low fee, the reasons that we indicated up here. Probably the best known of the management companies for index funds is Vanguard. That's the best known. It's been in the business of doing index funds for about as long as any of them. And it has, in its early years, it did a lot of specialization in index funds. You also have exchange-traded funds. They call them ETFs. An exchange-traded fund is kind of a hybrid. It's a mutual fund that's traded like a stock. So you have even more research to do because you're timing your buys and sells more in an exchange-traded fund than you would otherwise. If that's not something that appeals to you, then don't concern yourself with it. There are lots and lots and lots of other opportunities out there. In addition to that, you may have a hedge fund. Hedge funds are very speculative. They require large minimum investments. They pretty much allow investing across the board, anywhere that the money manager decides that they want to invest. So hedge funds, for most of us in this room, are really not appropriate. There may be some individuals that could do well with the hedge fund. I don't know. I know for my particular circumstances, a hedge fund is way too aggressive for something that I'd be interested in because they really give a lot of discretion to the money manager. Now, there have been some hedge funds that have done remarkably well, made huge returns, but they've also been some that, especially most recently, haven't done real well at all. So keep that balance in place. Now, when you're looking at mutual funds, doesn't matter whether it's a growth fund, an index fund, no matter what it is, there are some pitfalls. One of the pitfalls that you face with mutual funds is because there's so much information available, it's real easy to get involved in performance chasing. Right, and that is such things as market timing and day trading. You've probably heard of those. Those are performance chasing. Now, I will tell you that drama can be really good entertainment, but chasing performance is a great way to wind up drinking Maalox cocktails for lunch. And it's a great way to wind up making poor decisions, especially if you're own style of investing doesn't really enable you to take on that kind of risk, right? How about selling out when the market or fund goes down? Why would we sell out when the market goes down? Fear of what? Loss. Please, if you hear nothing else tonight, listen to this. The fear of loss is virtually always greater than the desire for gain. You don't think I'm correct there? I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. But let's just say for a second, I take a $1,000 bill out of my pocket and say, you take the same $1,000 out of your purse, put it on the table. We're going to take a deck of cards. We'll cut it, yours and mine, and whoever has high card wins $2,000. Now, there are probably a couple of you in here who would say, you bet, Bubba. Bring it on. I'm ready for you. But there are a lot of you saying, oh, man, I'm not going to take that kind of risk. I work too hard. $1,000 is a lot of money for a cut of the cards. You know, we'll go to our individual with a bachelor's and master's in mathematics. What's the probability of cutting? 1 in 13. Yeah, it's probably about 50%, you know, if you're just going to cut, that half the time you're going to win, half the time you're going to lose, statistically, if you cut enough, all right? That's not good enough for me to put a $1,000 bill on the table. So when you're following media hype, I'm sorry, when you're selling out when the market goes down, basically what you're saying is that this is too aggressive for me, and so I'm going to have to make another kind of decision. Now, when you're looking at these first two, the performance chasing and selling out when the market is fund going down, you're looking at day trading, you're looking at market timing. One of the things that I always consider is, who am I competing against? Who am I competing against? I was very fortunate when I was working. I had a chance to go to Boston to Fidelity Management Research Company's corporate office. And Fidelity Was started by a guy by the name of Edward C. Johnson II. It's a family-owned corporation that has $2.5 trillion under management right now. It's big, big, big business. We've got a Fidelity office right here with about 5,000 people, so it's big business. Anyway, I got to go to their, what they call the war room, which is their computer room, and I got to go through and talk to a number of different money managers, the people that are making the buy and sell decisions for these mutual funds that they have. And they have a lot of mutual funds with all sorts of different time frames and objectives and that sort of thing. The they're not interns. They're beyond interns, but they're basically the analysts, the people who are doing the homework on the different stocks that the money managers are considering either buying or selling. You're not dealing with dummies here. You're dealing with the top 1-2% of all of the graduate business schools up there in the Northeast. So you got Harvard and Colgate and University of Chicago, and out in the West you got Stanford. You're talking about really bright people that are working 70-90 hours a week. And they work for a couple weeks analyzing a stock so they can go in and brief the money manager and say, I think this is a good buy, or I think this is one you should let it go, or just forget about it. This is headed really for the pits. Those are the folks that we're trying to compete with, plus this billion-dollar computer system that they have. And you combine those kinds of capabilities against what we have available to us, and we pale in comparison. So performance chasing, selling out when the market is going down, and that's compounded by media hype. Now, I have an example here, and I'll be the first to admit that going back to 1998 is going way back, okay? But this is an actual illustration, and I think that it does clearly illustrate the problem that you run into here if you're believing everything that's in the newspapers. San Francisco Chronicle, September 1st, 1998. What is the headline in the morning paper? Panic hammers the market. What do you think most investors did when they saw that? They didn't run out and buy more, did they? No. They sold, because that is human nature, all right? The fear of loss outpaces the desire for gain. We don't want to cut a deck of cards for $1,000. And so they sell. The evening paper, also in San Francisco, that's San Francisco's morning paper, the evening paper, same date, stocks bounce back. Oh, dear. Now, if I sold what I had in the stock market and put it into the bank, and the stocks bounce back, have I missed an opportunity? You bet I have. Absolutely have. So don't allow what the free press is saying to impact your buy and sell decisions. I've got a great story that I'm going to tell you in a few minutes. If I don't bring it up, remind me. I had a chance to ride on an airplane sitting next to a reporter from Money Magazine. This is back when I was working, about 15 years ago now. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about the conversation that this individual and I had. All right, I need to give you a little bit more information before we do that, though, and it'll make more sense to you. But the lesson here is stick with a long-term strategy. Don't allow yourself to be fluctuating back and forth based on information that you read in the press. Okay. If you have money, or if you're going to invest, let me put it this way, if you're going to invest, when is the best time to invest? When you have money, right? Awfully difficult to invest when you don't have money. So when you have money is the best time to invest. Now, if I could provide you with an investment opportunity that looked like this, you'd all want it, right? Okay, if I could guarantee that it was always you're going to buy low and you're going to sell high, so I'm guaranteeing you a profit, you'd all want it. Absolutely. But can I guarantee that kind of performance in an equity? No, because sometimes it does this, doesn't it? It goes down. More typically, it looks like this. This is an actual depiction of the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the last 100 years. And isn't that really kind of what the market looks like? It does. I mean, it goes up, it comes down. Historically, the market has sought a higher level. That's historically what it's done. So we're going to take a period of time out of the stock market, and we're going to put it to work for us. We're going to do what's known as dollar cost averaging. Dollar cost averaging is nothing but an investment strategy that says we're going to invest the same number of dollars, each and every month, whether the market is high or the market is low. Now, that's not the same as buying the same number of shares. It's investing the same number of dollars. It's a totally different concept than just buying the same number of shares every month. Whether the market's high or the low, and our objective is to purchase shares at an average cost below the average price. All that means is if beans are on the shelf at $1 a can, you can buy yours on sale at 80 cents a can. That's all it means. At an average cost below the average price. So we're going to go through a 10-month example. We're going to invest $300 per month. We're going to invest $300 a month twice at $6 per share, here and here. Twice at $2 above 6, here at 8, and twice at 2 below, here at 4. Twice at $4 above 6 at 10, and twice at 4 below here. And then we're going to come out and evaluate where we stand. So for 10 months, $300 per month, and then we evaluate right here. When we evaluate, are we going to make money? Are we going to lose money? Are we going to break even? What do you think? Break even, make money. I haven't heard lose your money yet. Break even. Okay, let's see. Let's see what happens. The first month, we invest $300. We do that at $6 per share. So we divide 300 by 6, and we do, in fact, buy 50 shares. The market's going up. At $8 per share, we divide 300 by 8, we buy 37.5 shares. At the top of the market, we have $10 a share, so we're buying 30 shares once, 30 shares twice, and as sometimes happens, the market turns down. We buy 37.5 shares here again. We're right back to where we started at 50 shares at that point. Down at $4 a share, we're still investing $300, but we buy 75 shares. The market bottoms out. We have 150 shares 2 months back to back, 75 again, and then after that, we come out and say, okay, this has been fun, but I need to evaluate where I am. Am I doing any good? So we evaluate where we are. Now, if we add up all of these shares, they do, in fact, add up to 685 total shares. The current valuation is $4,110. How do we know that? We multiply $6, which is our valuation point, times 685 is $4,110. We invested $300 a month for 10 months, so how much do we invest? $3,000. That's the cost of 10 investments. Now, would you agree that the average price per share is $6 a share? Because we invested twice here at 6, twice at 2 above, 2 below, 4 above, and 4 below. So the average price is, in fact, $6 a share, right? Okay. The average cost per share, right? So we know that we have $3,000 as our cost of 10 investments. We have 685 shares. We divide $3,000 by 685, and the average cost is $4.38. So the average price is 6. The average cost is 438. Did we achieve our objective? Yeah. Why? Absolutely. If you didn't hear what she said, we bought more shares when the market was low. So it's called weighted averaging. That's all that it is. It's weighted averaging. When the market's high and people are screaming, Chicken Little Run, the sky is falling, you can't go off the deep end and buy too many of those high-priced shares. When the market is down here and it's really low, we have the golden opportunity of buying a bushel basket of shares at those bargain basement prices. We know that each of these shares is worth as much as each of these shares when the market comes back up, right? So we're buying when the market's up, and we're buying when the market's down. It's weighted averaging, all right? And this is in a market that's flat. It didn't go anywhere. Yes, sir?
You're assuming.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, generally, you can't do this with one stock because you can't buy one share with the same amount of money every month. If the market's going up and down, that one share's price is going to fluctuate. So this is truly an investment strategy to use with a mutual fund. And that's what you pointed out very ably. All right, so we got a market to move sideways, and we did, in fact, achieve the objective that we had set out to do. This is a very powerful strategy for individuals who have monthly dollars available that they can apply to long-term goals. Monthly is the key. Long-term is the other. All right? If you have both of those going for you, then this works really, really well. Now, this is in the flat market. If we take a look at our compound interest table, and this was on page H3, I think, in the back of your notebook, if I remember properly. Okay, if you turn that over on the back, you see the $300 per month, and that's this chart right here. If we take $300 a month compounded, if we have 30 years, long time to invest, we have 12%, the average in the Standard & Poor's 500 for the last 18 to 20 years, then we got $924,000, which is a significant amount of money for a reasonable amount of money invested and a reasonable amount of risk to assume. Because the fact that we're investing the same number of dollars every month and we're doing it into a diversified mutual fund, which has professional management, is going to modify or mollify the risk that we're experiencing. So that's a snapshot of dollar cost averaging. The story, I was talking about this money man, or the journalist from Money Magazine. And I was riding on the airplane with her. We were humming along, and we'd been talking about a number of different topics. And I found out that she was, in fact, a reporter for Money Magazine. And in fact, this was almost 20 years ago now, and she did have a monthly article that she was very proud of. And I said, "Now, I see from your wedding ring you are married." She says, "Yes, I am." Said, "What are you and your husband investing in?" Says, "Well, we're dollar cost averaging in money market accounts." Now think about what you just said. We're dollar cost averaging, what we just talked about, in money market accounts. In order for dollar cost averaging to work, what must the market do? It's got to fluctuate, doesn't it? It's got to go up, it's got to go down. The price or the NAV of a money market account is one. In fact, I did a little bit of research on it. I could only find one set of circumstances where a money market fund went below one, and that was in 1996, and it only went a few pennies below, and it didn't stay there very long. So she and her husband are dollar cost averaging into a money market fund. That's silly. That's ridiculous. It's not possible. You can't do that. What it showed me was she didn't have a clue what she was talking about. Didn't have a clue. So I dug a little bit further. I started peeling the onion. Now I was interested, right? And it turns out that her background, her experience, her education was at an Ivy League school, and she was a journalism major. She had never taken any courses in investing at all. But she was writing with a huge amount of authority, and she had a lot of people hanging on every word. So just beware of where you go for your advice. Make sure that it is not subjective, that it is objective, that the research that's being done is factual and is not being tainted by whatever specific interest group that person is associated with that's providing you with the information. Okay, so we have compound interest. We have it working for us. We know that dollar cost averaging is a very effective long-term investment strategy for individuals that have monthly dollars and would like to diversify in a mutual fund. And we can further increase our returns by looking at tax-qualified plans. We'll start off with individual retirement accounts. Well, I tell you what, before we talk about that, why are tax-qualified plans important? It allows you to defer taxes on an investment. Engage as well. We'll talk about that in detail in a second. Okay? But even more than that, what you find is that, according to Forbes, back in 1993, 38% of Americans who were working had a pension plan. 38%, 1993. What is that today? 13%. And 22 million of that 13% are working for the government or a labor union. That eats up 13% pretty quick, doesn't it? So if we don't have a pension, and I would venture that most of us in this room don't have a pension, if we don't, then it's up to us to make sure that we're planning for our own retirement. Okay? And a very effective way of doing that is with a tax-qualified account. And probably the best known of the tax-qualified accounts are individual retirement accounts. Now, individual retirement accounts, if we go to ERISA, then we see that that is where the specifications and the oversight for this come from. What is ERISA? Anybody know? What's it stand for? It's an acronym, I'll tell you that. Employee Retirement Income Security Act. Employee Retirement Income Security Act. That's what it is. All right? And it's that particular act which oversees the various kinds of tax-qualified plans. IRAs are one of those tax-qualified plans. So you have Roth or traditional. You take a look at the deductibility, the withdrawals, the rollovers. There's lots of different things to consider when you go here. So let's go to page H19. And this is a comparison of traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs. I'll just go through and highlight some of these for you. To begin with, basic eligibility. A traditional IRA, anybody under the age of 70 and a half can participate. And with a Roth, even if you're beyond 70 and a half, so you get an old guy like Dwight, Dwight could have his own Roth IRA. Right? He could not have a traditional IRA that he's contributing to. Right? Because you get to the point of having required minimum distributions, which we'll talk about in a second. So that is one of the things to consider. Another is income limitations. There are no income limits restricting contributions to a traditional IRA, but if you're single and you make $120,000 or more, then there is a restriction. If you're married filing jointly, it's $180,000. That's also for qualified widows. So $189,000 of taxable income a year is part of the contribution limits for a Roth. So that's another piece of the puzzle as you're trying to decide which of these would be the best way for me to go. Are contributions tax deductible? In other words, the money that we're investing, is that tax deductible? With a traditional, yes, with a Roth? No. By the way, what does Roth mean? Anybody know? It's what? It's named after the senator that put the bill in front of the Congress. Yeah. It was Senator Roth who decided what that was going to be. Are distributions required? RMD, required minimum distributions. With a traditional IRA, yes, they are. With a Roth IRA, no, they're not subject to required minimum distributions. But the beneficiaries are if you have a Roth. Now, what is a required minimum distribution? It just takes the amount of money that you have in your IRA, and it has tables. They call them actuarial tables. That just means statistically how long are you going to live. And then they figure out, based on how long you're statistically going to live, how much you need to take out of your IRA so that you can't continue to get rich on the government's dime. That's what it amounts to. Okay? So what are the advantages from a tax standpoint? Well, number one, with a traditional IRA, the money that you put into it, the contributions, are not taxed. All right, so they're paid with before tax dollars. With a Roth, if you put $5,500 in, which is the maximum amount this year that you can put in, then that's going to be after tax dollars. So you're going to have taxes that are going to come out before you actually put the money into your investment. Now, with both of them, dividends, capital gains, interest are going to be tax deferred. Okay, or tax-free in the case of the Roth. And the reason they're tax-free is that distributions with the traditional are taxed as normal income. With the Roth, they're not. So let's think about what's happening here. With a traditional, you pay with before tax dollars, so you don't have taxes coming out of the money you're putting in. Is that a plus? Yes. With a Roth, you pay the taxes up front. With the traditional and the Roth, the earnings are either tax-free or tax-deferred, depending upon what you have. They're tax-free if they're Roth, they're tax-deferred if they're traditional. And then as you're taking the money out with traditional, it's taxed as normal income. With a Roth, it's tax-free. So with a Roth, you pay taxes going in but not coming out. With a traditional, you pay taxes coming out only, not when they're going in. They're going to get you one way or the other. All right. What you got to do is decide which of those makes the most sense for you. All right. You put in required minimum distributions into that formula, and it starts having a number of different moving parts. But you can generally come up with a pretty good estimate of which of those makes the most sense for you. All right. Can you borrow? Can you borrow from the IRAs? Well, you can have a rollover. Rollover is limited to how many days? Anybody know? 60. And if you don't return the money to the IRA from where it came from, what happens? You get a penalty and taxes. The penalty is how much? 10%. So if you take $1,000 out and you don't put it back in, you just say, I'm going to take it out and spend it because I'm going to Vegas. Yay, right? So you take $1,000 out, you got a 10% penalty. That's $100 off the top. Plus, it's taxed as normal income. So if you're in a 20% tax bracket, all right, that's another $200 off. All right, you're starting to whittle down on your retirement savings here pretty quickly, aren't you? All right, so you don't want to do that. If you want to borrow it for something less than 60 days and put all of that money back in, that is a source of revenue for you to do that. Now, there are also provisions for first-time home buyers. You can withdraw $10,000, up to $10,000, and not have a penalty for that. And also, you can take money out, withdraw money, for some medical expenses, for disability, and for some education expenses. The point here is, folks, there's lots of considerations, things to analyze. Don't just say dartboard, I'm going to throw and say Roth traditional, you know, because I do think I need an IRA. Do some calculations. If you need to have somebody help you make calculations, have somebody help you make the calculations. But figure out which one is appropriate for you, because usually, generally, typically, normally, most of the time, one or the other is going to be better for you and your family. Okay? So do that kind of analysis before you just wildly get involved into it. We've already talked about early distributions, maximum contribution, $5,500 for the year. Yes, sir? Yes. You can convert from traditional to Roth. You can revert, go back from Roth to traditional. And what you can't do is go back and forth within the same year. Can you have both? Absolutely. Yeah. If you want to diversify your IRAs to some traditional and some Roth, yeah, you can do that. They're separate accounts. But the total amount that you can invest is still $5,500. Yeah. Plus, if you're 50 or older, you have another $1,000 catch up on an annual basis. So you have $1,000 that you can additional to the $5,500 that you can put in there on an annual basis until forever with a Roth, and until you're 70 and a half with the traditional IRA. So, do I encourage people to have an IRA? I certainly do. And there are a number of considerations for rollovers and borrowing from an IRA. And make sure that you are aware of what those are before you make any rash decisions. Don't just jump into a decision to take money out of an IRA. And for gosh sakes, don't use an IRA as a savings account. That's going to complete. In fact, you'll be better off just putting it into a jar in the backyard. You really will. When you start taking the penalties and the tax requirements, a jar in the backyard would be a much better solution for a short-term need than taking an IRA and ravaging it periodically. Putting money in and taking money out is a poor, poor way to manage an IRA. I was just told that I forgot a very important part of this. Thank you. That's the discussion of 401ks, 403bs. It won't take us but about 2 minutes, so I'm still working on our time, all right? 401ks, that is a different kind of investment from an IRA. I was getting so excited that I was early, I just zipped right through. All right, it's a tax-qualified investment. Right now, there are 70 million people investing in 401ks. That's a pretty good portion of the population between 18 and 65 in this country. There's $4.7 trillion invested in 401ks. The maximum investment for an IRA on an annual basis is $5,500. With a 401k, it's $18,000. So it's a much more flexible type of investment. It's the average plan in Fidelity, and theirs was easy to find, but the average plan for them is approximately $90,000. And it can be either set up as a Roth or as a traditional 401k. One of the greatest benefits of a 401k is that some companies will have a matching feature, and it could be anywhere from 10 to 100%. So what's the big deal here? Let's say that you put $1,000 in, and it's matched at $1,000. Show me anywhere that's available in the economy today where you can get guaranteed 100% return on your investment. And it's legal, it's moral, it's ethical, okay? There's no place else that you can do it. So the maximum possible investment that you can make, if a 401k is available, and especially if it has a matching component with it, I would strongly encourage you to do that. Now, there are eligibility investing requirements with most companies. A lot of companies will say you have to be with them for 6 months. Some others say a year before you're eligible to start investing. And then the vesting part of that, which is, are you able to take the money? Is it your money? It's really what it amounts to. Is it your money, not the company's money? Also requires various periods of time. It just depends on how much emphasis the company is placing on that. And you can find out from your human resources, your personnel department, just exactly what that would amount to. You'll have options of where to invest your money, usually 5 to 7 or 8 different options, anything from very conservative, which would be fixed instruments, to very speculative types of investments, and everything in between. So you can decide how you want your money to be managed and where you want it to go. And usually, typically, normally, most of the time, this is a great deal. And I would strongly encourage you to avail yourself of that. If you're self-employed, you have KEOs available to you. And KEOs really have two different kinds of benefits. You can have defined benefit or defined contribution. That's just the way that the allocations are decided. And if you're going to do this, I would strongly encourage you to work with a broker so that they can sit down and explain the options, explain what the company is offering. If you're working as sole source, even though you're an independent contractor, you're working sole source, they will have either a defined benefit or a defined contribution plan available to you. And then a 403B for school teachers, which has many of the same features as a 401K does for other employees. One question.
Comparison to 401k.
Oh, absolutely. Match out the 401K because you can invest more. If you're able to invest more than $5,500, then the 401K is a way to do it. You do have lots of flexibility, but the matching feature is really one that is just real hard to pass up. All right. As Dwight mentioned earlier, we do not have a class next Wednesday because next Wednesday is the 4th of July. So happy Independence Day to each and every one of you. We will be meeting on the 11th. On the 11th, we're going to be talking about buying a home and getting into some pretty significant details about that. I've purchased 8 homes in my life and sold 7. And most of that was the result of a misspent youth. I did a lot of moving around when I was young. So I have had a lot of experience at buying homes and have learned a lot of different things, some of those the hard way, and would like to share some of that with you in a couple of weeks. So we have beaten our 8:30 deadline by a couple of minutes. Thank you for your attention. And have a wonderful 4th of July, a great Independence Day. Have a blessed week. Let's close with a prayer, if we could, please. Our most gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the opportunity to gather together this evening. You are the holy and perfect God, and we marvel at your plan for us. We ask that you help us take the information we were exposed to tonight and use it in a way that will help us be good stewards of the gifts that you have blessed us with and use them in a way that would be pleasing to you. Watch over each and every one of the families represented here this evening and help everyone get back to us on the 11th safely. We ask in your son's name, amen.